Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
So this is fantastic. This guy, he's a pediatric emergency physician. He's going to present five papers that give me the answer to everything. And we're going to walk out of here with concrete ideas of what to do in five topics in pediatric emergency medicine. So I'm a pediatric emergency physician, which means I'm naturally predisposed to not being a researcher. I am actually the Sydney Children's Hospital, it's the PREDICT site rep, so PREDICT, a lot of you have heard the PREDICT talks from Stuart, so I have been part of some of those research days, and I find research really difficult. Where does a talk like this and a session like this sit in this conference? I think it's, we heard from Greg Kelly about reliability on day one and minimising unwanted variation, so I guess research and papers provide some of the data that inform how we might minimise variation. We've heard this morning from Mike about uncertainty and dealing with clinical uncertainty and the role that guidelines might play in that. So some of this research informs guidelines, but Greg also told us that the big wins have already been made, and research now is about trying to find the small differences between things, and this is especially hard in pediatrics. We know that big randomized controlled trials in pediatrics are really hard to do, and we've actually all been really lucky at this conference to be presented with the results of the concept study looking at Keppra versus phenytoin. Having been partly involved in that, that was a huge undertaking. And the words that stuck with me was Stuart said that we're really only going to get the answer with a meta-analysis. Even with such a big study, we don't really have a complete answer. So it's in that frame that I'm going to try and present five papers that aren't going to answer all of your questions, but they'll hopefully start discussions. And the way that I've tried to choose these is not replicate the other papers that have been presented at the conference. I've picked five papers of different types of studies. Of five topics that were sort of interesting to me and that were relatively recent. So I wanted to start with a question for you all. So each of these is going to start with a sort of question and a hands up. So if I was to ask you in the audience the slightly loaded question, do you agree that 0.9% sodium chloride is better than 0.5% sodium chloride for deficit replacement in DNA? So if you agree with that, put your hands up. Sorry? Plasmolyte, that's a whole other question that I believe Sarah McNabb answered last year. does anyone disagree that 0.9% sodium would be better than 0.45%? So I'm not necessarily going to answer that question, but I just want to present an interesting paper that came out recently. It was a trial of fluid infusion rates for diabetic ketoacidosis, and some of you may have seen this paper. As I go through these papers, I'm going to go through this format. So I'm going to go through a PICO sort of analysis format that some of you might be familiar with. So this was actually a prospective randomized trial. P stands for population. So who did this trial involve? This was children from 0 to 18 years enrolled in the PECARN Pediatric Emergency Research Network. So that's similar to PREDICT, but a big American pediatric research network. Just as an aside on that, there are a few big networks around the world. So there's PERC in Canada, Peruki in the UK that I know Damien's had some involvement with, PREDICT in Australia, and PECARN in America. They looked at what was the intervention? They looked at four different fluid regimes and randomised children to receiving those four different regimes. There was no control group, and their primary outcome was a deterioration in neurological status, because we all worry that giving low sodium fluids to children with diabetic ketoacidosis will result in cerebral edema and brain swelling and adverse neurological outcomes. So this was the intervention, and thanks Grace for these slides. But basically the fast group got a 20 mil per kilo bolus of normal saline compared to the slow group, which got a 10 mil per kilo bolus of normal saline. And within each of the fast and slow groups, for deficit replacement, so after their bolus for deficit replacement, they got randomised to 0.9% or 0.45%. The 0.9% group in the fast group and the 0.45% in the fast group got their fluids over 36 hours, essentially, and 48 hours in the slow group. And the slow group was only 5% replacement fluids, and the fast group was 10%. So the fast group got more fluids faster, and the slow group got less fluids slower, and within each group, there was high and low sodium concentration. So essentially, what did they find? They found no difference in neurological outcome between the two groups, which I found surprising. It sort of goes a bit counter to what I thought. You know, I'm always worried about fluids and giving cautious fluids in these children. I guess, like with all studies, it's up for debate, so I don't think this is the answer. I think their numbers, it was probably not powered to detect an actual difference because the incidence of significant neurological outcomes in children with DKA is about 0.9%. And so it's going to be difficult to have enough children in a study to detect a small difference. But I guess what this study does give us is some reassurance that when we're worried about assessing exact, you know, fluid deficit and what fluids we should be giving, that there's some evidence to suggest that we're probably going to be okay, and as long as we continue what we do in all our guidelines, which is regular monitoring, regular electrolyte checking, then we're probably doing the right thing. So I'm going to move through these pretty quickly. My next question is about procedural sedation. So for those of you who are involved in procedural sedation of children in emergency, would you agree that propofol is just as safe as ketamine for procedural sedation in pediatrics? So hands up if you agree that propofol is just as safe as ketamine. So a few people. So who disagrees that propofol is just as safe as ketamine? So more people. I know there's a lot of love for ketamine in this group. So this paper from JAMA essentially was a prospective cohort study, and they just looked at a population of children less than 18 years old. It was PERC, so this was a Canadian study. It wasn't a control trial in that it was prospective, and they just saw what people did, and people entered what they did onto a database, and then they analysed the outcomes of that. So they had a various range of sedation regimes. The most common was ketamine, so 62% of children on this study were sedated with ketamine alone. And then the next most common was ketamine plus propofol, so ketofol that a lot of you have heard of that has a lot of theoretical benefits. And then ketamine, midazolam, propofol alone, ketamine plus fentanyl, propofol plus fentanyl. Again, there was no control group, and what they looked at was adverse events, both serious, what they classified as serious adverse events and non-serious adverse events. They looked at significant interventions. And so what did they find? So sorry, this is a little bit busy, but hopefully a colourfully entertaining slide. They found that overall there was a total of 11.7% adverse events, but most of them were not significant. So what are the significant adverse events? They're apnea, of which there was 0.9%, laryngospasm, hypotension, bradycardia, and desaturation and vomiting were the most common sort of considered non-serious adverse events, which is probably not surprising to those of you who do procedural sedation. Ketamine was essentially safer than propofol or combinations of ketamine and other agents. So for the ketamine group, of which there was 62% totally given, there was only 0.9% incidence of serious adverse events. There was 2 to 4% with any of the other combinations. And I found this interesting because while I don't do it, I'm often thinking about why don't we do ketofol where I work? We tend to do ketamine, and I think, why aren't we doing more ketofol? Because, you know, potentially it's safer. I guess the only thing to say about this study is that it did demonstrate that overall procedural sedation is very safe in children. And while I haven't presented it, when you look at the interventions that needed to be made, there were very few interventions that needed to be made. And specifically with propofol, the comment that the authors made was that propofol is very short-acting, so any of the side effects from propofol were usually pretty transient and no significant interventions needed to be made. No children needed to be intubated. So essentially, my take-home from this is it's a good study because it informs some of our practices around procedural sedation. I think it reflects that, you know, a lot of us use ketamine frequently and are familiar with that, but overall procedural sedation is safe in children, and I think it doesn't change what I think, which is you use the agent that is most familiar to you, and you're probably going to be the safest at using that agent. So moving on now. So for those of you that intubate children regularly in ED, which is all of us, right? We all intubate children regularly in emergency. I am more likely to use rocuronium to intubate a child in ED than succinylcholine. So put your hand up if you agree with that. So I wonder if I'd asked that question 2 years ago, if anyone would have put their hand up. So I've noticed a trend towards rocuronium as well. So this was just an example of another type of study, which is interesting, and it's a registry, it's a descriptive study based on a registry database. So this is the NEAR registry, which is a big registry of airway interventions and intubation with sites in the USA, Canada, and Australia. The population is actually a group of children at an adult or mixed ED. So most of the emergency departments that provide data to the NEAR registry are mixed EDs or adult EDs that might see children. So I'm not sure, someone can tweet out or correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not sure if any of our tertiary children's emergency departments in Australia or New Zealand are part of this registry. I know that some are part of, there's NEAR for Kids is another registry that I know the guys in New Zealand are part of. So the intervention was intubation. Again, there was no control. And because it's a descriptive registry report, so they're just describing a lot of interventions. A lot of outcomes. I'm not going to present all of them here. But I've just listed some of what I thought was interesting. So they looked at 1,053 intubations. In and of itself, I think that's significant because we know that intubating children in ED is a relatively rare phenomenon, so anything where we can get information from a big number is useful. The most common indications for intubation were trauma, seizures, pneumonia, or cardiac arrest. They reported adverse events of 15%, and I won't go into the details of what they listed as adverse events, but you can imagine desaturation, apnea, well, obviously apnea. They noticed a trend over time to use less and less pre-treatment, which I think, I would agree is reflected in what people are teaching. More rocuroniums being used in pediatrics, reflecting, I think, a shift in adult practice. Again, availability of video laryngoscopy was reflected in this, and people are using video laryngoscopy more and more. Interestingly, they reported an 83% first pass rate, which I think is, from other studies I've read, is a relatively high first pass rate for pediatric intubation. And there is a whole body of literature around safety of intubation of children in emergency departments and who, if anyone, is an expert at that. And I would contend that probably none of us are experts at that, but together, working together, we can all be experts at it together. So that was really just quickly going through that one as an interesting descriptive registry study. And reflecting on registries, I wonder if, and this is another little aside, I wonder if the future, one of the future avenues of research are big registry studies where we can enroll big numbers and analyse for small differences in treatments as a way of being able to get more meaningful information, because these big randomised control trials are really difficult to run. And I was listening to Mike's talk this morning on fever, and I think about that a lot. And, you know, wouldn't it be great if next year we could come to Don't Forget the Bubbles and say, look, in the last year we've registered every single child that presented with a fever to an emergency department in Australia, New Zealand, the UK, America and Canada, and here's some data we can present on the epidemiology of their disease, on the clinical factors that predispose to serious bacterial infection. So think big. Okay, so this was an interesting, I found this particularly interesting. So for those of you who do lumbar punctures on children, and there might be a few of you who occasionally get a traumatic tap when you do that, how do you correct for that potentially traumatic tap? So the statement I'm presenting you with is I correct for traumatic taps by using either the peripheral full blood count or the 500-to-1 rule. So if you agree with that, would you put your hand up? So I do that, and many people who've worked with me as registrars or fellow staff specialists know that I'm always doing that calculation on the peripheral full blood count, saying what's the ratio of the white cells to the red cells in the peripheral full blood count. So this group tried to study this and tried to say, well, what is the best way to correct for a traumatic tap in infants? So this was a retrospective cohort study. So I'm getting progressively less and less sort of meaningful in terms of study design. So a retrospective cohort study where they basically just looked back at all the children under 60 days that had bacterial meningitis and looked at the ones who had traumatic taps and whether they could work out an ideal correction factor that would minimise the number of false negatives but also minimise the number of false positives. So what did they find? Through sort of logistic regression, they derived a ratio of 877-1. In total, they looked at 20,319 lumbar punctures. Of those, 14% were traumatic. I'm happy to say I think that's a fairly low proportion of traumatic taps, just quietly. And of those, Mike reflected this in his talk this morning, that the number of infants under 60 days who had a lumbar puncture in this study that actually had bacterial meningitis, as defined by a culture-positive CSF with a suspected pathogen, was 33, so 1.1%. So they looked at those children with meningitis and the traumatic taps and tried to work out how to get a number that would minimise false positives without leading to more false negatives. Essentially, there's a lot of description around this in the study, but I'm just going to distill it down to a few points. So it was not useful for the under 1 monthers. They found that the authors conclude that 877:1 was as good as 1,000:1, so why not use 1,000:1? But when you look at their tables, 500:1 was just as good as well. Interestingly, looking at the peripheral blood count, that probably wasn't as good as the others. So for me, I'm always banging on at work about, sit down and be clever and look at the full blood count and calculate the ratio and don't use 500:1. So I wonder if I'll start reflecting on that and maybe changing what I do around that. My other reflection on this is, I think it's potentially significant as we're moving to an era where we're being more and more less and less conservative, I guess, with the management of febrile neonates in the 1 to 3 month age group. And so I know the Royal Children's Protocol has, and they've been doing this more recently, sending children home who've had a lumbar puncture based on the microscopy results, saying if it's not look like meningitis and they look well, there's a potential you might send them home. I've never done that yet in my practice. But as we move more and more to that, the significance of a cell count on a lumbar puncture helping us diagnose whether a child has meningitis or not might be able to go home becomes more significant. So this is just something that will inform that and let us think about that. I think for the under 1 monthers, most of us, I think, in the audience who are doing a lumbar puncture in a child under 1 month would be admitting them for antibiotics until we get culture results from them. They also didn't look at viral meningitis in this study. I want to finish with a PREDICT study, so shout out to PREDICT. And I want to ask the audience another slightly loaded question. In your opinion, PEM physicians have good enough evidence to support their management of severe asthma? It's one of the most common things we see. We're all experts at asthma. So put your hands up if you agree that PEM physicians have good enough evidence to support their management of severe asthma. No one agrees with that statement. So this was and I know this was sort of alluded to in one of the other sessions yesterday, I think. This is the PREDICT prioritisation study. So PREDICT being the Australian Paediatric Emergency Research Group, trying to work out what's the future direction of paediatric research, where is the money, where are the gains going to be made. And this was a Delphi study, which before I was involved in this study, I didn't know what a Delphi study was. So essentially, a Delphi study is a way of just getting opinions in a structured way to inform what we're going to do. And so what did they come out with? They came out with a few research questions. So that one of the top questions was the question that paediatric emergency physicians in Australia and New Zealand wanted answered was, in children with severe asthma, does a specific intravenous agent compared with another intravenous agent or placebo result in improved outcomes? Now, I'm sure all of us who look after children with severe asthma use intravenous salbutamol less and less. We use magnesium. But there's actually no data to support that evidence. So what was another question we asked, in children who require emergency intubation, does the use of high-flow nasal oxygen during intubation attempts compared with standard practice improve outcome during and post-intubation? Another high-ranking question was, in children presenting to the ED with presumed sepsis, does low volume compared with high volume fluid resuscitation improve outcome? And Elliot Long, as you've heard, is looking at that and doing some research into that. This is a great study because it came up with 35 research questions. So for those of you in the audience who are looking to do some research or to do a college project, this is a great place to go to look at some of these questions and go, is there something I can contribute to helping, in a small way, answer some of these questions? The other really fascinating part of this study was that from the first run through, 48% of questions that were, about 50% of questions that were asked by emergency physicians were deemed by the reviewers and authors of this paper to have already essentially been answered in the literature. So, and I think that supports that concept of knowledge translation and how long knowledge translation takes. So I've presented you there with five sort of slightly different papers, nothing amazingly groundbreaking, but hopefully I've exposed you to different types of studies and different types of papers in emergency medicine and given you some papers that you can take away and have a think about how or if the results of these papers will impact your practice and to start some conversations in your workplace around what you do and how these might contribute to you minimising variability and whether they will affect any of your guidelines where you work. Thanks.